We're going to go ahead and begin, gentlemen.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Good with me.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this rainy morning, September 23rd, 2016. Welcome to our committee, everyone. We have a full agenda this morning for this informational hearing. I would like to begin with an informational hearing on foreign direct investment. And I'd like to invite Evan Hoffman and Matthew Miller up to the dais. I hear one is...
Oh, they're both here.
Ah, thank you. Perfect timing, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for having us this morning. Chairwoman Ewan and representatives of the committee, we are excited to talk about one of our favorite topics bright and early this morning, foreign direct investment. We call it FDI, and so that's what that means when I refer to that throughout the presentation. Foreign direct investment is when a non-U.S. company invests in the United States, either by building a new facility or acquiring a U.S. asset and then growing that asset. My presentation will focus on more macro-level trends and where America stands globally compared to the rest of the world, and Matt will dive into some of the specifics with Oregon. So what is my organization? The Organization for International Investment. We are a trade association based in Washington, D.C., and you can see a copy of our membership. It's been distributed to everybody. We represent the U.S. subsidiaries of globally headquartered companies. Our companies come from all industry sectors, and they have global headquarters from all around the world. But one thing our companies do share in common is that they make the unique decision to invest in the United States and create jobs here. AFI's mission, our organization's mission, is to work on a policy environment that attracts foreign direct investment into the United States. And we do that at the federal and state levels. And then once these companies invest here, we work to ensure non-discrimination for their firms and their U.S. employees. So why do we care about foreign direct investment? It's a great example of economic growth, bottom line. These companies employ 6.1 million U.S. workers across the United States. To think about it this way, it's about 5% of the private sector workforce in America. And these companies are companies that every legislator wants to attract into their community because they bring a lot of added economic value beyond the jobs. A lot of their investment is concentrated in manufacturing and innovation. Because these are high-value economic activities, they tend to pay higher wages, so they pay 33% more in terms of average wage across America. And they're very charitable companies, and you can see how much their charitable giving has grown over the last decade. When I ask legislators what percentage of the U.S. workforce is in manufacturing, folks respond to me, oh, maybe 25%, maybe 7%, maybe 15%. It's 9% according to the National Association of Manufacturers currently. An added benefit of attracting foreign direct investment is that their investment is most concentrated in manufacturing. So 37% of all foreign direct investment jobs in the United States are in manufacturing. So that's just an added benefit. In addition, these companies fund 16% of all U.S. research and development activities. And if you think about it, this makes sense, right? America has the best university network, the best network of engineers, scientists, labs, a strong rule of law, strong IP protection. So it makes sense that global companies want to locate their research and development efforts here. And then one other thing that folks don't often realize is that foreign-based companies, when they invest in America, use America as an export platform to sell to the world. And so global companies account for almost a quarter of all U.S. exports. So where does America stand globally? Last year, the United States attracted $350 billion worth of foreign direct investment. That was the most of all time, so that's great news. All told, America is the world's number one recipient of foreign direct investment. We attract about $3.1 trillion of foreign direct investment over time. But I do want to draw your attention to that white line that kind of cuts across the red bar graph. That white line represents the percentage of the world's foreign direct investment investment that America attracts. So last year, we attracted 22% of all global foreign direct investment. If you extend that white line back to 2000, then that number stood at 37%. So in 2000, we attracted 37% of all worldwide global investment flows. That number has dropped to 22%. So that is a trend that we're trying to reverse on our policy work that we do across the country. Here are the countries that invest most often in the United States. 75% of all foreign direct investment comes from 8 countries. So those 5 countries there, and then in addition, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Ireland round out the top 8. In Oregon, there's a little fact sheet I also included with your packets at your desks there. I think it's Germany, the UK, and Japan that represent the top 3 investors in Oregon's economy. So we have many member companies with operations in Oregon. You can see a taste of our member companies on the backside of that sheet. Examples include Daimler in Portland, Genentech in Hillsboro, Garmin in Salem, Representative Hack, I believe that's a constituent company. Avangrid, they create wind power in Sherman County. Thomson Reuters is in Lake Oswego. Siemens has many sites throughout the states. All told, our foreign direct investment accounts for more than 50,000 jobs in Oregon, and you have about 600 firms that have chosen to locate here from across the globe. So let's dig a little bit deeper into Oregon. This is how Oregon ranks vis-a-vis the rest of America. You can see the percentage of its private sector workforce that is reflected from foreign direct investment, 3.5%. But the really cool statistic is the one on the right with the red arrow. It shows that in the last 5 years, foreign direct investment employment grew at 5.3% in the state, outperforming the private sector overall. I will just say one thing. These stats are backlogged 3 years. And so I know that recently Oregon has seen a lot of job growth and new investment over the last few years in particular. So I do want to, you know, I'm curious to see what these numbers look like in a couple years when the government comes out with new data. So a lot of what AFI does is try and tell the foreign direct investment narrative in creative ways. In today's political environment, there's a lot of folks questioning the essence of participating in the global economy. So a lot of what we do is try and show, well, foreign direct investment is a place where we should look to throw resources at because of all the added economic benefits that we just spoke about. So we've tried to frame this story by saying foreign direct investment attracts the jobs we need, those innovation jobs, those manufacturing jobs. And as part of this study that we just released this year, we focused on understanding the complete impact of foreign direct investment beyond direct jobs. So what are the supply chain jobs that come as a result of foreign direct investment? And then when those employees spend their paychecks in local communities, what are those induced economic impacts? And so we mapped that out, and Oregon, you can see here, 200,000 plus jobs are attributed to foreign direct investment in the state. And all this data is available on our website, as you can see there. Okay, so let's dive into a little bit of practical advice for the state here. Every 2 years, we poll our chief financial officers about the pulse, their pulse of the U.S. investment climate, how the U.S. ranks globally. CFOs are key contributors to deciding where corporate capital gets allocated across the globe. So it's just really interesting perspective for us to research every 2 years. So this is an interesting chart here. According to our CFOs last year, they're feeling less confident in the U.S.'s investment environment overall in terms of the next 12 months. And a lot of that is attributed to the high corporate tax rate at the federal level and some regulation issues that have emerged recently. But despite this, America does remain the top and most attractive destination for their investment among other advanced economies. When you dive into why a company may choose Oregon versus Iowa or California versus Washington State, the three most important reasons that a company may choose to invest one place over another, number one is proximity to customers and the ability to grow their market share, and that makes sense. Number two is that skilled workforce that's critical to global companies. And number three are economic incentives. They play a role as well when it comes down to choosing different locations in America. Once that company locates here, then this is a really important slide for us because it asks our CFOs, what could state government be doing to create an attractive and even more attractive environment? Excuse me. an even more attractive environment for global companies that are already located in your communities. So according to our CFOs, the top three most important things, number one is maintaining high quality infrastructure. That makes sense. Number two is facilitating permitting, licensing, and assisting in other regulatory issues. And number three is ensuring non-discrimination in U.S. law. So just because a foreign company has global heritage doesn't mean they should be treated any differently than their U.S. counterparts. We work as an organization across the country with governor's offices, with economic development organizations at the regional and local levels on helping them understand foreign direct investment attraction strategies. And these are a few of the key things that we always work with these organizations on. You can take a look at them. I know Matt's going to dive into some of these details, but I do want to highlight the importance of aftercare. That's kind of what I just spoke to on that last slide. So what can state governments be doing after the fact to help existing investors grow, and that kind of aftercare strategy helps both U.S.-owned companies and foreign-owned companies in your community. And so we can talk about a little bit of that in Q&A if you guys are interested. The other thing I want to call to your attention is that last bullet, ensuring non-discrimination. That's part of AFI's mandate, and so that's really important for our member companies as well. And I want to enclose by just by talking about one issue here in Oregon. As the Economic Development Committee tasked with creating policies that attract investment into Oregon, I just want to flag this one issue that is currently acting as a barrier to foreign direct investment, which is really critical to our member companies. And that issue is the tax haven list. Many of you may be familiar with this issue because last year it received a lot of attention when there was a bill that would have added Switzerland and the Netherlands to the state's tax haven list. The issue emerged in 2013 as a way to prevent corporate income shifting, as a way for Oregon to protect its tax base, of an admirable goal that every single state shares that same goal to protect against tax evasion. The policy sought to accomplish this by listing certain jurisdictions as tax havens, and then if a company has operations in one of those jurisdictions, it would be subject to additional Oregon taxation on that income earned in those jurisdictions. The reason why it's a concern for foreign direct investment is because the policy does not distinguish between that abusive tax activity, which the policy was designed to go after, and then any legitimate business activity that could be occurring in that country without tax-motivated purposes. So an easy example to think about is the Bahamas, right? That's a country that's on the current list. Let's assume, hypothetically, that a company grows in the Bahamas organically in 10 years, and they have thousands of employees there, and they want to invest in the United States to grow in the United States as well. So they're planning on building a new research center, a manufacturing facility, distribution warehouse. The moment they would invest in Oregon, because they happen to be located in the Bahamas as well, and because Bahamas is on the tax haven list, they would suddenly be treated like any company that may be using the Bahamas as a tax shelter. And so distinguishing between those two types of examples is really important in order to keep Oregon very competitive for foreign direct investment attraction. And please feel free to use our organization as a resource. There are other states that have looked at this issue and have chose different policy directions that allow the state to target that abusive activity, but which don't carry those unintended consequences of going after legitimate business activities as well. And so, I really appreciate the opportunity to comment before this group, and I look forward to any questions. Thank you.
Shall we complete the panel and then turn to questions, if you don't mind?
Okay. Welcome. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Matt Miller. I'm Vice President of Business Development at Greater Portland, Inc. We are a regional nonprofit economic development recruitment firm for the Portland metropolitan region. We represent seven counties and two states, two in southwest Washington and five in Oregon, Columbia, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Yamhill counties. Our mandate is to market the region for domestic and international investment. We assist companies through the entire market research, evaluation, due diligence process and connect them to existing resources throughout the state, throughout the region as well. Our focus is on traded sector industries, so high value added industry in six cluster areas: computer and electronics, software and IT services, athletic and outdoor industry, health sciences, clean technology, and metals and machinery manufacturing. About a year ago, our organization launched the Greater Portland Global Trade Investment Plan, which I have a copy of, and I don't know if my materials were entered into the record, but there's a link to this document, but I'm happy to provide that document to you after the fact. The plan was jointly produced with the Portland Development Commission and advisory committees comprised of partners throughout our region. It is a project of the Brookings Institution's Global Cities Initiative. It aims to elevate our region's global engagement to catalyze new opportunities for trade and investment. Evan explained what FDI was. I want to elaborate a little bit on why it matters. So even though it might account for 5% of national employment, foreign direct investment accounts for 15% of capital investment in the United States, almost 20% of corporate R&D, and almost 20% of exports. FDI facilitates the spread of new knowledge, technology, and ideas, flows critical to innovation and competitiveness in the global economy. In Greater Portland, foreign direct investment, we're the 23rd largest metropolitan region in the United States. We're 29th in foreign direct investment employment. That's 41,000 plus jobs in Greater Portland alone. Our foreign direct investment is heavily concentrated in manufacturing. A case study example is Shimadzu in Canby, Oregon. Shimadzu USA Manufacturing is a division of Shimadzu Corporation in Kyoto, Japan. They manufacture analytical instrumentation devices for the pharmaceutical and high-tech industries. In 1998, Shimadzu relocated from the East Coast to the West Coast to improve communications with its Japanese parent and to expand access to global markets for strategic competitive advantage. The company has since grown to more than 100 employees regionally. Other examples in Greater Portland include SolarWorld and a host of semiconductor supply chain companies in Hillsboro, Subaru having just announced an expansion in Gresham, Ajinomoto, Daimler, and Adidas in Portland, Kyocera in Vancouver, Jaguar Land Rover in Portland, and there are hundreds of other examples, over 120 alone from Japan. So how do we go about doing foreign direct investment? How do we actually execute in terms of recruitment? Our organization, along with a number of other regional and state partners, proactively recruit into foreign markets through going out and talking to these companies, going out and talking to the consultants that they hire to evaluate markets. We also leverage Business Oregon and their foreign office resources. We do this proactively through marketing. We leverage the U.S. Department of Commerce's Select USA program. This is a program focused specifically on attracting foreign investment into the United States. An example, recently I went on a mission to Japan. We visited four cities over a week with the Port of Portland and Business Oregon's Japan representative office, where we were able to market to over 250 potential possible foreign direct investors. Critically, Business Oregon and their foreign offices have been a part of every aspect of what we're doing. Opportunities to increase foreign direct investment. So despite the fact that Portland, Greater Portland, is the 23rd largest metro and we're 29th in total FDI employment, we're still 50th in the intensity of that employment, so the percentage of foreign direct investment of our total employment. The region has strongly performed in exports abroad, however. We're the fifth fastest growing export metro among the 100 largest in the United States and 13th by export volume. So we're trying to understand how we can leverage and learn from our exporting excellence to drive future foreign direct investment opportunities. A lot of the tactical details about how we might go about doing that is in this plan. Just specifically four points that we're focusing on is to have industry-specific and also the stage of growth-specific strategies and tactics. So the semiconductor industry, for instance, they have a different set of needs than, say, software and IT, and we're honing our techniques and our approaches to go after those opportunities. As Evan mentioned, it's critical to have a well-resourced retention and expansion effort for companies either looking to export that are homegrown here or for companies that have come here and helping them to grow. I mean, this is exactly the reason Shimadzu continues to expand here. And then we've prioritized our markets. We are focusing on five in particular. Our top three right now are Japan, Germany, and Canada for the Greater Portland Metro. In closing, right quick, while we have a host of tactics in this plan and we have an accompanying policy memo that outlines actions that, if undertaken, we think could enhance investment in Greater Portland, I wanted to call out one of those recommendations in particular, which is to maintain and expand resources in Business Oregon, and including their foreign offices. They have been invaluable to our efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Do we have questions from the panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
I just wanted, what were the three top countries you were concentrating on?
Our top three right now are Japan, Germany, and Canada.
And what was the reasoning for that choice?
We have looked at the propensity of those markets to have investment already in Greater Portland, but also a focus of those governments to more proactively push investment outside of their countries. We have a whole host of metrics upon which we've kind of calculated a prioritization. The other two are China, I believe the UK, round out those top five. But what we're trying to do is say, how, you know, with limited resources, how can we get the biggest bang for our buck, I guess.
Yes, follow up.
My only other one was, when you're looking at our resource, I guess we have a lot of water. We mm-hmm. have, you know, a lot of resources, you know, in certain areas of need. Mm-hmm. So how do you analyze that as far as, you know, cost-benefit analysis on, you know, bringing in a particular type of investor, but how much are they going to be utilizing either scarce resources or resources that are plentiful?
That's a good question. So what we... You know, we'll market to whatever competitive advantages we have, and I think, you know, like electricity, which is predicated on our hydroelectric capacity, mm-hmm. has left our electricity rates very stable and predictable, and the cost has not been volatile by any means. So, you know, that plays into some of the analysis that they're doing. You know, for, say, water intensity, we frankly haven't seen a lot of industry that have had water-intense uses, but I think it's going to factor into their matrix of considerations. We try to provide them that information. We try to work with them in other jurisdictions to help understand those cost and benefits.
And I don't want to have you think that I was making an analysis on our water. I was just using that as an example, because there's some parts of our state that have more water than others.
And land is a great example in Greater Portland. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think it's so dependent on what the project is. It's dependent on what their end goals are that I couldn't point out any one example, but happy to sit down and talk through some
thank
of the
you.
Ways we've worked with companies in the manner.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, and thank you both for your testimony. The legislature is often best at responding to crises as opposed to setting up sometimes forward-thinking plans. So in that vein, what are the risks that you see out there right now to Oregon foreign investment? We talked about the tax haven legislation, but just what comes to mind anecdotally to me is that Oregon and the Portland region in particular has had a competitive advantage for housing and housing prices, land prices compared to other West Coast metro areas, and frankly cost of labor. That seems to have eroded perhaps in the last 3 years. I'm just wondering what, A, if that's true, and B, what are other risks to attracting foreign investment, advantages that we may have historically had but could be losing if we don't take action?
Yeah, I think maintaining affordability both in land and housing is critical. I mean, it is one of the our strongest value propositions is that we are probably one of the most affordable and highest value added economies on the West Coast. So, unfortunately for policymakers, that's not one thing in particular that you can point to try to address that. It's myriad factors that you have to consider. So, yeah, I think land supply is an issue. I think housing affordability is an issue. Those things put pressure on the cost of real estate, both for people and for business. Those costs on real estate put pressure on wages, and so you're going to have that tug. I think that said, I still think we have a very compelling value proposition vis-a-vis the markets with which we compete. So What we need to be able to do, I think more, even at the regional level, at the local level, and certainly at the state level, is be able to market those opportunities to companies. So, you know, and with tight budgets, we shouldn't forget about how invaluable it is to have people proactively going out there and marketing to these opportunities. So, you know, a well-resourced recruitment function, a well-resourced retention expansion function at Business Oregon helps all of our regional and local partners.
Yeah, and I'll add, almost 80% of foreign direct investment job creation comes from your existing investor base already. So expansions is the way that many of our member companies choose to grow in the United States. And within the last few years, there are countless examples, Jaguar Land Rover in Portland, TE Connectivity, Genentech, Daimler have all expanded and put a lot of capital investment into the state. And so the state that has an extremely comprehensive and aftercare strategy, one which works closely with companies to identify current needs, issues, really is positioning the state for future success, I think. And so I would consider, you know, I would encourage the state to take a look at Business Oregon and all the resources and strategies they use in terms of going out to their existing investors and understanding corporate needs. I think that's just a way that Oregon can position itself vis-a-vis the rest of the country in a more competitive way.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following on the previous question, Measure 97 would impose a 2.5% tax on everything over $25 million. Has that type of possibility come up in your discussions?
I've heard from several of our member companies that that is a concern, as you guys can probably imagine. OFI doesn't have a position on that specific measure, but you know, we always come down to non-discrimination in treatment in any law and regulation. That's critical to attracting foreign direct investment. So I would just, you know, we don't have a position on that issue, but I do know it's a concern to many of our members.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
This is about 9 years ago. I think I was sitting in this exact dais. We had the president, I think, of Solar World from Germany here, and I asked him what his biggest concern was about bringing that company to Hillsboro, and his response was the delay you guys seem to impose upon any activity in getting permitting and other things done. He said, so would you please help reduce the process through which we have to go to bring our factory here? That was 9 years ago. I don't know how long you guys have been in business, but have you seen, have we been improving? Have we reduced that big heap of hoops we have to hop through to bring a new company here, in your opinion?
I think we have. I mean, there are communities in Greater Portland that are as competitive with some of the hot markets in the Western United States as I've ever seen from a permitting and timing perspective. But it's a patchwork. I mean, not all communities are the same. You know, Gresham is a great example that has a, you know, a 66-day commitment to permitting. Hillsboro is right there with them too. And time to market is a critical factor with companies, and you know, anytime we run into delays, that's money. And so we've run into projects where they've run into all sorts of surprises, and that has been a problem. But then there have been situations where it's flown very easily, and you know, the municipalities and the companies are pleased with the end result. So I think we just have to continue to work at it, and we have to look to best practices in the United States.
Yeah, and I'll add that this is attracting foreign direct investment has becoming an increasing focus of the administration in D.C. as well. The creation of Select USA a couple years is the first time that the federal government has a federal agency dedicated exclusively to attracting foreign direct investment and working with states on that effort. I feel the U.S. is really well positioned to continue to capitalize. $350 billion last year demonstrates that. With the slowdown in China and the economic turmoil in Europe, America really looks like that bright spot for global companies that are looking to expand market share and grow. And so it's a really exciting opportunity, in my opinion, for the United States.
One other thing I'd like to add is one unique thing that I've noticed in Oregon that I think is a best practice that is the regional solutions team. They work very closely with our community partners, with the regional groups. I mean, they bring everybody together to try to streamline any sort of state regulatory and regional regulatory issues. So that's been a very helpful thing for us.
Representative Lively.
Thank you. So my question has to do with kind of the federal. I appreciate what we can do in the state or not doing what the federal does, but I'm trying to understand the connection between this trend one way or the other based on our economy and how strong our economy is and the value of our currency. Because I read many cases from a standpoint of exports and so on. There's all this fluctuation and change depending on how strong the dollar is,
sure,
or the other currency. So I'm just trying to understand from a standpoint of attracting investment, doesn't that also play into it from the standpoint of when people might invest or might not?
Absolutely. And this is why I think this is probably why the turmoil in Western European markets with Brexit and things like that have made us maybe de-emphasize the UK market and things like that until we can understand the risks and implications there. So so we're going after the markets where we have tried and true and stable investment opportunities, and those have largely been Japan and Germany.
Sure. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your testimony today, and thank you for being here. This was very interesting. I'm going to follow up with one question.
Okay.
I was looking at the list and listening to the companies that you were referencing that are here. This doesn't look like a complete list of Oregon companies.
Correct. That's correct. So there are over 600 U.S. subsidiaries of foreign-based companies operating in Oregon. Our membership list is about 175 companies, so that just is reflective of our membership list.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the clarification.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, I would like to call Troy Costales, Shelley I'm not going to get this quite right, Oilier, and Shane McRhodes, please, to talk to us about safe routes to schools, a very important topic as we enter this 2017 session.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'll let the two that have joined me introduce themselves, and I'll come back and start with the presentation.
Thank you so much. In any order you choose, please.
I'm Shelley O'Lear, the Bicycle and Pedestrian Coordinator for Washington County.
Welcome.
And I'm Shane McRhodes, the Safe Routes to School Program Manager at 4J School District in Eugene.
Madam Chair, the legislature has talked about this particular program and stepped into it very formally back in 2005 with the passage of House Bill 2742, which established in law the Safe Routes to School program. That was done in anticipation of the federal action by Congress under the Safety Lieu Act, which is the transportation funding. And at that point in time, Congress created an earmark specifically towards Safe Routes to School, which had funding as well as some program expectations. And so by your leadership, what was established in statute was an expectation upon the Department of Transportation and the Safety Division to bring together a coalition of program partners from around the state and representing the different pieces of what Safe Routes to School attempts to work on, and with the goal of identifying and reducing barriers for children to walk, bike, scoot, skate to and from school. And it's a great spot of being able to blend health and transportation in the same conversation. And hopefully you'll hear both of that from my partners here at the table about what they've been able to achieve. The five areas that the program was built on was to focus on education, not just of children, but also for the adults in those schools and the community at large. Encouragement with the children, you know, certain types of incentives for them to be physically active. Enforcement around school zones in the areas of the children as they separate motor vehicle traffic away from those that are walking, scooting, skating. Engineering efforts was a specific call out at the federal level as well as here at the state level. Evaluation, which is a way to look at the area around the schools and what the needs might be. And recently on the program area that we've been working on, we added in our own sixth one around equity. And making sure that we're not just geographically diverse around the state, but also about those that are able to participate. Our program partners have been involved with us all the way along. This is not something where the safety division sits back on high and figures out what's going on. It is turned over to program partners such as these two to help us figure out the choices that we make. The funding, and in the written testimony given to you, you can see that during 2008-2012, when Safety Lou was our federal funding source, over $11 million was put into infrastructure projects around the state. There was also non-infrastructure, which is that encouragement, enforcement, education piece, and that effort still continues today. The Transportation Commission and ODOT as an agency has continued to flex some federal funds that are allowed to do the non-infrastructure side of education, encouragement, and allowing local action plans and evaluation, and that's about $500,000 a year that goes towards that particular area. And we just recently released a call for proposals from local schools, put about $1 million out, took 3-year bundle of money and put that out for schools to be able to participate in. And there's roughly half a dozen to 10 schools that are participating again in the non-infrastructure side of their encouragement and local action plans. As a result of this program, over the last decade, there are more children actively involved going to and from school. And there's more activity as well by the local community. A benefit of this program, particularly on the education and on the infrastructure side, is that everybody in and around that school benefits. It's not just for the children. It has other users that are available to use those infrastructure too. And the schools that step up and make this happen are because of local advocates like these two. It's not something that you can force on a local school. It's not something you can force a community to do. It takes somebody that's in a spot that is willing to be an advocate and a spokesperson and that spark plug in order to pull all these things together. And our hope with the funding that we have today, we're able to partially help fund part of the people that are at the Safe Routes to School program area, but also give them some resources to be able to use at that local area. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn the microphone and the presentation over to two program partners, and they'll show you some of the great work that they've done in two different areas of the state.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair and representatives, again, I'm Shelley O'Lear. I'm the Bicycle and Pedestrian Coordinator at Washington County. In 2011, Washington County created my position from scratch, recognizing how important walking and biking is to the county and the need to grow that as part of our transportation system and make that more robust. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about our program.
Oh. I guess you scroll.
Oh, scroll. So a little bit about Washington County and our schools. We have 124 K-12 public schools representing seven school districts. We have 13 cities in the county and over 87,000 students. So there's a lot going on. I think that just as the bicycle and pedestrian coordinator, I had a lot on my plate, and I realized I didn't have capacity to tackle all of the schools in the county. So I applied for a non-infrastructure grant to fund a Safe Routes to School coordinator position through the state to help create these partnerships and to create a program at the county. So what we did with that was really starting a Safe Routes to School program from scratch. So this was really starting by educating what Safe Routes to School is to the community, to our partner agencies, to even to some of the school districts, creating that awareness. And then establishing basic contacts with each of those entities, the cities and the school districts, to have a person designated to be a contact for Safe Routes to School, even part-time, to be a partner in our conversation. Just getting that started is an important part. And the other part we really understood is that we needed to determine what the needs are out there, because we had a lot of players, and we didn't. All of them are starting at different points. So one of the things that we realized is that some school districts didn't even have policies policies in place about walking and biking to school. So they weren't even ready to start doing encouragement activities if they don't even have a policy in place to say, yeah, it's okay for kids to walk and bike to school, and we're gonna be promoting that. So some places were starting there. Others, we were evaluating what their existing activities, encouragement activities were, and what was already going on. So doing that evaluation, and then really understanding what the infrastructure needs and priorities are. You know, the county is an entity that builds has a lot of roads and infrastructure, and we knew that that was a key part of it. So our Safe Routes to School coordinator really provides leadership in working with our partners and collaborating to bring everybody together and to have these conversations and move our program together. So one of the things that we realized in our parent surveys is that one of the biggest barriers to walking and biking cited by parents is a lack of sidewalks, traffic-related safety, crosswalks, things like that. And so one of the things that we, as a county, we really needed to understand, well, what are the needs and what are the priorities and, you know, what are the resources that are going to be necessary to address that? So we conducted this school access improvement study, and it's an inventory of the bike and pedestrian networks, and it was identifying gaps around 53 schools and 50 locations, the elementary, middle, and high schools. And here's an example of the inventory, and I've also provided an excerpt of a couple of the schools for you so you could see up close kind of what the content is. So we looked at, these are primary locations in urban unincorporated Washington County and or else schools that have significant impacts, are significantly impacted by county roads. What we did with this was actually collaborating with the school districts and Safe Routes to School action plans generated by the school communities, identify projects that would improve safety, projects that would just increase walking and biking and access to the schools, and also address hazard areas as defined by the busing requirements that the school districts has. So by addressing some of those hazards, we might be able to, in the end, eliminate some busing for the school districts and thus save them money and encourage more kids to walk and bike, enabling more kids to walk and bike. So one of the results of the studies, like, or how do we use the study? So the first part is, I mean, now we have an idea of what the needs are out there for biking and walking around the schools and what the required resources. And, you know, excluding our major road rebuilds that need to happen, we came up with a list, a project of more than $100 million. So we knew that the price tag for just those 50 schools was going to be big, but at least we have a handle on it. And we have a list of priority projects that are ready for funding, whether it's through grants that are available, or also when we look at prioritizing other projects, we can see where they line up with other priorities at the county in our spending. We've already started tackling those. We've used the county commissioners have allocated some of the gain share funding to the county, $2 million per year, towards these Safe Routes to School projects. So that's one of the commitments that has been moving forward. And we have been applying for grants using some of those gain share funds as match for that, to try to leverage those funds even further. So having the list is great to go to because we have a priority. We also have assurance that the projects are going to make a big impact on the schools, because not every project, every need is on the list, but they're priority projects and that have demonstrated benefit. Then we also, you know, kind of on the side, is by doing these networks, we can see which schools have more complete networks. And so those schools are the ones that we realize are prime for more encouragement programmatic work, because they've already overcome a lot of that barrier of the lack of sidewalks and infrastructure. So they're the ones that are prime. So we can actually focus some of our programmatic work and in-school work and encouragement in a place where the infrastructure is already there to support those kind of activities. So what's next for us? Obviously, we're tackling our infrastructure list and always looking for more ways to do that. Creating capacity around our partners. We've been supporting school districts and some of our local cities to apply for grants to fund their own Safe Routes to School coordinators, part-time or full-time, to create more capacity to try to get at those 124 schools that we have. Rather, you know, the more out there, the more that we can reach out to. Teaming up with our Health and Human Services Department, they are going to be great partners moving forward here in the past and moving forward doing health impact assessments with us, doing data collection and doing a lot of evaluation of what the results of increasing walking and biking mean to our schools and to the county as a whole. And then I think that really trying to build our capacity to increase the skill and safety education that needs to happen at the school level. You know, the county, we don't do a lot of like in-school work, so trying to create partnerships that will help get us those resources to where they need it in the schools. And then lastly, really teaming up with our partners as we go through this process and understanding the needs. We understand that there is a lot of policies that may be obstacles to achieving what we need to do as far as increasing walking and biking. So partnering with our agencies, the school districts, to look at policy changes that can happen at the local level, at the state level, and even at the federal level and regional and our regional MPO level as well, to really foster and remove barriers for us to really expand our programs.
Thank you.
Great, Madam Chair and representatives. Again, my name is Shane MacRhodes, and I'm the Safe Routes to School Program Manager at 4J School District. I'm also a leader for the Every Kid Coalition and a parent to these three kiddos, Isadora, who's seven, and Gus and Ben, who are six. Mm-hmm. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about our local program, its partnerships, projects, and statewide connection, and overall talk about the needs and opportunities that Safe Routes to School addresses. First, we couldn't do the work we were doing in Eugene and Springfield without the support of a lot of people and organizations. These are a few that help us do what we do, from the City of Eugene Public Works to the local advocacy organizations, to make our Safe Routes program successful. I'm going to highlight that having Safe Routes to School coordinators in our transportation departments with the district is a little uncommon, yet really advantageous for us. There's only a few Safe Routes programs throughout the country that have that, and working with our transportation departments and school bus drivers on getting kids to school safely is a really great connection. Next, I want to tell you about some of the six E's that Mr. Costales told you about, and look at on the ground how that is applied in our program. We integrate all the E's of Safe Routes to School, but unfortunately I don't have the time to go through all of what we're doing, so I'm just going to highlight some of the ones that I'm excited about in our program. So first, education is one of our strongest programs, is the Bike Safety Education Program. It's grown over the past decade, where we had one fleet of bike that reached two schools a year. We're now reaching over a dozen schools and reaching approximately 70% of our students. We teach sixth graders during their PE time with a 9-hour bike safety education curriculum. We have three fleets of bikes and 40 bikes and gear at 4J, and a fleet in each of Springfield and Bethel school districts. Two of these fleets of bikes are built right in Eugene by Bike Friday, who now manufactures fleet bikes for districts around the country after our pilot program in Eugene. These classes are key pieces of creating safer cyclists and even better drivers, as these are the students' first driver's ed courses. We also have a growing pedestrian safety education program that is held during the school hours in second and third grade and is first introduction to traffic safety and neighborhood connectivity. We're currently reaching about half of all second and third graders in the district with this 2-hour course. After education comes the other important E of encouragement. We hold events throughout the district to celebrate Walk and Bike to School Day, which this year is just under 2 weeks away on October 5th. We have over a dozen schools geared up to do group walks, bike blended smoothies, class competitions, and other fun things to encourage more active transportation. If you have a chance to go out to an event in your area, I highly encourage it. And then each spring we connect with the commute challenges that happen throughout the state.
Is that a statewide event or is that
it's
Lee
a national
County
event?
Yeah.
National
event.
Walk and Bike to School Day is a national event, and so we do that celebration locally.
Thank you.
And then there's national and then statewide commute challenge type events that happen in the spring, and so we hold a Walk and Bike to School Challenge month in May. I'm also proud of our critical mass rides that we started in Eugene. These monthly family-friendly bike rides start in a neighborhood park and then roll to some fun event or location in town. This coming month, we'll meet at a park and ride to a local farmer's market to drink apple cider, eat healthy snacks, and carve pumpkins.
Great.
One of our most popular rides is a family bike camping trip with over 30 families that participate in these rides, get families excited about biking and have proven popular not just in Eugene, but are now being done in communities throughout Oregon, the country, and the world. And I'm proud to say it's one of the innovations that the Northern Europeans have actually borrowed from us. With engineering, I wanted to highlight the importance of dedicated funding. Before we were able to complete many small projects that bundled into one school with the Safe Routes to School grants, important pieces of sidewalk connections, safe crossings, path connectors, and other projects got done because they weren't competing against large projects. We need a return to dedicated SRTS funds to help complete these connections to schools. At the district level, we see the importance so much that we were one of the first districts to include off-site safe routes projects with our new school bonds. With this last bond, we dedicated $1 million to connecting our four new school buildings to safe routes beyond the school property. And this is where I wanted to place a little personal plug. I started doing the Safe Routes to School work before I had kids, but now it's all more important and personal to me. And as my kids are riding with me through our city and starting to gain independence, it's clear to me that we have not built our cities for children, families, safety, and people in mind. We've made it easy to drive, but made it very difficult for children to walk or bike to school. We have a lot more work to do, and this needs to change. And it can't just happen through education and encouragement. We need to have this vision for creating communities that are built for our children and safety, and it has to include funding to build safe routes for my children and the thousands throughout Oregon who deserve it. So how does this play out in Oregon? First, we have a dwindling level of dedicated funds, as I mentioned, and there's currently very little funding available to help support youth safety in schools and neighborhoods as they work to build an active and healthy community. There's also been many safe routes successes throughout the state. The Safe Routes to School Network partnered with Alta Planning and designed to create the first Oregon Safe Routes snapshot in 2015, and these slides are images from that report. We are seeing an increase in student participation, as Troy mentioned, and in encouragement events and students receiving walking and biking education during school, and an increase in schools that have completed their Safe Routes action plans. And you also heard how in 2008, there was $15 million awarded for Safe Routes infrastructure projects and that were built in our schools. These affected about 17% of Oregon students with at least one safety project. But as we also heard, urban schools need approximately $1 million, and urban and rural schools approximately $2 million to address safety concerns for students, parents, and staff with connections to school for Safe Routes. A major benefit to addressing these needs is that health risks will drastically decrease as kids and families get 66% of their daily needs of exercise, walking and biking to school. In this map, we can see the direct correlation between type 2 diabetes and Title I schools. Health disparities like this are a big problem, especially in kids in those Title I schools. But this is a problem that we can solve with the six components of Safe Routes to School. And in order to bring Safe Routes to School for every kid, we need help. In the coming months, I hope you'll have the opportunity to help significantly expand the Safe Routes program in Oregon by dedicating funding to the projects and programs. And I thank you for your time. Again, I'm Shane Mack Rhodes with 4J Safe Routes School and also For Every Kid Coalition, working to make Safe Routes to School for every kid in Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Mack Rhodes, I appreciate your testimony, all three of you. This is a very important issue and is a topic that's high on the radar for conversation. A word of warning, when I moved back to Oregon with my very, very young family, the first volunteer work I did was as a crossing guard at my local elementary school when my children were wee small. And I look back to that as the initial volunteer service that put me on a path which, who would have thought, landed me here. So go home and warn all of your crossing guards that you never know where that service may lead you in the decades that are to come. And we appreciate their very good work because it's not easy to stand out there in the rain and the snow helping kiddos across the street. So thank you very, very much. Questions from the panel. Representative McLean.
Well, I want to thank all three of you because I think what you see in front of us is the very best of what we're doing in the state of Oregon as far as starting real networks and real partnerships for safe routes to school. But as many of us on this committee know, as we've gone around the state, and Shane, right, as you've just pointed out, we're not done.
No.
And we've heard over and over again in 11 different meetings about how important this dedicated fund is for real infrastructure. And I, looking at the Washington County map, I don't see W.L. Henry on the list that you gave me. And quite frankly, W.L. Henry, I've spent the last 2 years with their parents talking about, and they're not on the list to be helped. They're not prioritized. Trying to help them figure out how to get now kindergarten and preschool age kids to school with no buses, which if we're going to encourage them to walk and bike, then we have responsibilities to make sure that all the infrastructure is in place. And those kids are leaving at 6 a.m. in the morning from their homes, and they're walking by themselves or with groups of kids or possibly one parent with 10 or 15 kids to try to get across a couple of pretty challenging roads. But not only that, we just had a fatality in Hillsborough just this week. We lost a mother and two small children. And we have much to do in this area, and we've got to dedicate. The education, I think we're coming along. The wonderful bike and pedestrian types of programs to encourage good activity and good exercise, I think we're coming along. But just as you pointed out today, the spine of this program to encourage means we have to do the infrastructure. And we have to put up those lights, and we have to get those sidewalks, and we really have to commit to trying to make every child safe. Every child, not just some child's or the prioritized schools, but we've got to work on it. And it's really a passion right now, I think, for many families because of some of the biking and pedestrian activities and accidents that we've had because we have encouraged it. So it's one of those wonderful stories where we've got a good goal and we've got a good start, but we can't stop. So thank you.
Representative Lively.
Another sign of encouragement. So some of you know I've been working on this for some time and have a strong passion. So last night I met with ARP, and they think this is tremendous because it doesn't just, when we talk about safety, so it isn't just kids in schools. And I hadn't thought about that particular angle, but elderly and other people, handicapped and so on, it's a huge issue. Also them being able to have access to that. So they thought this is an exciting thing to support and also help find ways to make more investments because all of those that need access in communities would benefit from these efforts. So I just thought I would share. We've got an alliance going here.
Yeah.
I would like to comment. We visited our transportation committee, the joint committee, the big committee, visited Hillsborough on Monday, and we actually had the pleasure of stopping at a relatively new elementary school that is growing exponentially. They plan to add 200 students to this school in a very short time with the development that's coming in. And in the conversation we had with the principal, it was stark and stunning to me that they had one student walking to school in a school of 460 students.
Wow.
And part of it had to do with the lack of infrastructure in a relatively new community. I was absolutely stunned. So I think it's just one more illustration of the fact that we do have work to do and people care deeply about this. And it will continue to be a topic of conversation as we move forward. Comments? Thank you very much for being here today. Next, I would like to call up our friends from ODOT to give us an update on implementation of federal Real ID.
I don't think we need Real ID.
This is going to be good.
Welcome. Nice to see you this morning.
Okay. Good morning, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation here with Tom McClellan, DMV's administrator. I'm going to start off with some sort of Real ID 101, and then Tom's going to discuss some recent information we've received and that causing us to ask to come to this committee to inform the legislature about Oregon's status with Real ID. And we have been before you before, but I will give you a bit of a 101 on Real ID as a reminder. So the Real ID Act of 2005, passed by Congress and became law, was around the security of states' driver licenses and ID cards. There were 42 very specific requirements in three general areas. One is the security of that plastic card itself. Another was the information supporting the issuance of that card and the information that's found on that card. And the third area of security is the physical plant and the personnel that do the issuance, that do the work around issuance of driver licenses and ID cards. The penalty for a state that fails to comply with the federal Real ID law is not monetary, as we usually see in federal requirements. Instead, a state that fails to comply with Real ID, its credentials, its ID card and driver license, at some point will no longer be acceptable for federal identification purposes. Federal Homeland Security has issued a staged enforcement schedule. Currently, the point we're at in that staged enforcement is that at nuclear facilities and federal military installations and some federal buildings, a state's credentials that are noncompliant and a state that is not under an extension, those credentials are not acceptable for identification purposes to enter. In January of 2018, it kind of comes the big one everybody's worried about, the ability to get through TSA and board a domestic commercial flight. January 2018 is the first time that a state, again, that is not compliant and is not under extension, that state's credentials will no longer be acceptable. And finally, the last date in the schedule is October of 2020. At that point, the only way to use a state's credential to board a commercial flight or enter these facilities is if the card is compliant and it's marked as such. I want to reinforce, because there's a lot of confusion around this date, that January 2018 for boarding commercial flights, no state, even those that today are noncompliant, no state will have that enforcement until January of 2018. And so to enter those facilities without a compliant card or one under extension, you'll need to use another form of identification. Typically, we're talking about a U.S. passport or passport card. So Oregon, as we all well know, is not compliant with Real ID, but we are under an extension that our current extension expires October 10th of this year. The main reason we are not compliant is that in 2009, the legislature passed and the governor signed Senate Bill 536, which effectively prohibits compliance with the Real ID Act. We aren't allowed to spend funds to become compliant unless the federal government pays for that and reimburses it. And while there was some federal funding available for states to become compliant, nothing like what was necessary to become fully compliant. So over the years, Oregon DMV has made small administrative changes that served a purpose other than Real ID, but also had the effect of getting little bits closer towards compliance. And so using that information and those efforts, ODOT has been able to secure three annual extensions for the state of Oregon. That's why we're under extension. But again, our current extension expires October 10th of this year. That deadline is approaching, and we have some sort of new information to share with the legislature.
So, welcome. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. And as Amy indicated, we have heard some more recent information. We're in fairly regular contact with our counterparts with the Department of Homeland Security, and just recently received an email reminding us about this October 10th deadline and encouraging us to submit additional information for review of potentially another extension. But in that email and in verbal conversations with them, they've made it pretty clear that a state that has the type of prohibition that we have in statute is less likely to receive another extension. And there are several states that are in that same boat as Oregon is. We still intend to submit an extension request because we have made some improvements. We have some projects underway that tangentially will probably make some improvements. But without that, with that prohibition in statutes, and it may not get us that extension. And that's mainly why we wanted to be here today with you, to let you know that. We've heard that a commitment of the state to make some changes. They know that a state cannot change state law when the legislature is not in session. So they recognize that that's the case. And with the time frames we're looking at, what they're mainly looking for is some other indication that the state is maybe reconsidering a past position or is even really ready to make some changes. Barring that, we don't know if we would get that additional extension. Like I said, that we will submit and make the best case possible and see if we can buy some additional time. As Amy had indicated, the January of 2018, which is 16 months away, that's the point in time at airports that a state that is not deemed compliant and doesn't have an extension, those cards will likely be not accepted. Some alternative form of identification would be required at that point. And as was indicated, a federal passport and a passport card is the most common thing. There are other types of documents on the Homeland Security website that potentially could be used, but it's kind of limited in the type of work you might do or the type of experience you've had or, you know, military IDs and things like that. So mainly to let you know that. We're not making any particular request of you today. It's more just informational to let you know the time frames and the potential implications on the path that we are on today. In fact, if you were to direct us to make some changes with our computer systems, it actually could have some impact on some important IT work that we're trying to undertake. Representative Lively, I think, understands that. He's on a task force that's overseeing our service transformation program. Although maybe not directly an impact, it could have some tangential effects on that particular project. We also have two other active IT projects. One has to do with imaging of documents. The primary thing that we do not comply with today is the imaging of the identity, legal presence type documents, the birth certificates, passports, immigration documents, even Social Security cards. We require people to present that the first time, and then we hand it back. We look it over and say, yep, that looks like a valid birth certificate. We hand it back. We don't keep a copy. The federal regulations require that you keep a copy, keep some record of what you saw, what you received. That has been the largest concern in the past, and we've talked to legislative committees about that collection and retention of those various fundamental identity type documents by another state, you know, another government agency keeping those types of things. So that would affect that project. It would also affect our driver license replacement project that's going on. We're bringing on a new vendor and new equipment and software to issue driver's licenses. The card is going to change, and we'll have some additional security features. But a compliant state needs to include some indicator on the card that it is a compliant card. And that's what TSI agents will be looking for in October of 2020. When they're looking for a compliant card, they look for a card that in some states is a gold star or a gray star. It's in the upper right corner. That's what they've indicated they're looking for from a compliant card. The state also, once they start issuing a compliant card, must indicate on other cards they issue, if they're not compliant, that they are not compliant. There's actually language they're looking for on the card. We also don't do that today because we don't issue a compliant card. So those are some of the things that we would have to commit to do if we were to become or try to become a compliant state in Oregon. So that's a lot of information for you.
Sir McClellan, I think I have three questions. First of all, you mentioned federal facilities. Will our federal courthouses in the state of Oregon require this? I know you talked about nuclear power plants and others, but what about our federal courthouses?
Yeah, Chair McEwen, that's a difficult question to answer because when we've asked our federal partners, they have no definitive list of what the federal buildings are.
So that's yet to be determined.
To be determined. However, I will say two things. One thing they indicated to us was that they're not aware of anyone being eventually turned away from a federal building. They've been able to get folks to present other documents or however they secured it. Also, there are certain constitutional requirements. For instance, a defendant entering a federal building has a constitutional right to have their hearing, so they couldn't be barred. So what we've been told is nobody they're aware of at the federal level has been denied access. but they have not been able to give us a list of what federal buildings we're talking about.
Okay. Second of all, I remember in a prior update, there was a number attached to the cost to the state to implement this. Do you recall what that ballpark, what that number was, the cost to ODOT to implement?
Chair McEwen, it depends on the approach the state takes. If the decision is made that every card that we issue will be a compliant card, it means every Oregonian must resubmit their legal presence and identity type documents, which we just finished that 8-year cycle. It was 2008 that we started requiring that, and we're just the last people are trickling through with that requirement. If you want Oregon's card, our standard card that we issue, and ID cards to be issued as compliant, it's going to cost much more than if we offer essentially a second tier or a higher tier card that people could choose to apply for, mm-hmm. and present those types of documents, maybe even pay a higher fee to recover the additional costs associated with that, but it'd be a choice. That option would involve fewer people, only those who thought they needed it or wanted that type of a card, which we estimate could be 20% to 30% of Oregonians. Because they already have a passport. There's other reasons why someone would not choose not to obtain that type of card. The cheaper of those two options, the one is an alternative card, a secondary type card, we've estimated about $1 million to implement and potentially $2 million every biennium for the ongoing cost of our staff to keep up with the workload.
And is there any indication at the federal level that there has not been money forthcoming in the past? Is there any indication that there could be in the future?
Chair McEwen, nothing is specific to this as far as federal funding. There's emergency management type funds that are important. They're used for important things that potentially could be used for something like this. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that. But as far as specific outlays of federal grant monies for real ID compliance, there is nothing.
Thank you. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you both. For your testimony, do we have a rough estimate of how many states are compliant or will be compliant?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Davis, attached to the testimony we submitted is a map of the U.S. kind of color-coded for which states are compliant, which states are completely non-compliant, and those that are under an extension. So I think we're at about 23 states are non-compliant but under an extension, and we're one of those. Kind of the next question is, with the deadline looming, you know, how many states are looking at becoming compliant? We received that question in Senate Transportation yesterday. So we've done some some researching of some other states, and certainly some states have committed to becoming compliant and have indicated they're on track and will have a compliant card by X and such date. So my thinking is that come this new deadline date and in the near future, I think this map is going to change with some of those colors changing to compliance. But right now we're at about 23, so, you know, roughly half the states are not compliant.
So we're in good company is what you're saying.
That is true, Chairman.
Follow up. Yes, sir.
Thank you. And I know you're not on the federal team, but do you get a sense if there's any, I mean, there's a battle looming that sounds like it's about 18 months out. Between the federal government and a lot of states, a huge population that's going to face this. Is there any reverse pressure that we're seeing on federal delegations to maybe question the efficacy in light of recent data breaches, to having each state government retain copies of birth certificates and highly critical documents? Some of us are a little more comfortable with our credit card number being stolen because we have fraud protection, but I don't think the state issues fraud protection with birth certificates these days.
Yeah. Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, I will say that I'm seeing several states submit compliance packages, knowing full well they don't fully comply, but are making very strong arguments that things they do are comparable, essentially materially compliant to what the regulations and the law of the federal government say. And they're putting it in the lap of the Department of Homeland Security to decide whether, yes, this is close enough, or no, you're non-compliant. An example would be Virginia. They've submitted a compliance package. They do not keep the copies of the documents. What they do is they're using some electronic systems that we don't use in Oregon, and are committing to use other ones that will verify birth certificates, passports, and to assure that someone doesn't have a driver's license or an ID card in another state. They're either using those systems, actively preparing to use those systems, or committing to use those systems, and they're making the case, isn't it just as good or even better that we're doing that kind of check before we issue? We're not going to keep a copy. We don't want to keep a copy of these documents, an image, you know, image document. So they are making that case. And it certainly is a strategy that I'm seeing many states take. They know they're not meeting 100% of the requirements or even the letter of what the law might say, but they're making a very strong case that we're materially compliant. We're doing some things that are at least as good and perhaps even better than what the regulations indicate.
That's, and I'm just thinking while Vice Chair Davis was talking, if you're born in Oregon, as I was, my birth certificate is already on file with the State Records Department in the vital statistics realm. It's already there.
Yes.
So if a breach of that occurred, that information is out there already. It's just mind-boggling what's going on in the world of cybersecurity right now.
Yes.
and how the state in all of its processes has to protect that information. But what we're doing here is creating another layer, which I understand can be challenging. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that's already out there. Yes. Vice Chair Gorsuch, did you have a comment?
I do,
comment?
Yes.
And then Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if, let's say, in an ideal world, let's pretend that the federal government gave us money. I know that's a fantasy, but at any rate. And we created the two-tier system. Mm-hmm. How much would it cost a driver to get the higher tier? What would be the cost of that? Just an estimate.
Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, I don't even want to venture a guess. Until we've done a full analysis of the cost, mm-hmm. And some estimates of how many people are going to be requesting those, it's hard for me to say what that delta would be. I hate to venture even a guess. But
yes.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is passports are not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so would it be less than getting a passport? Any guess on that?
So, Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, first-time applicants for a passport, it's $135.
Mm-hmm.
First-time passport card is $55. Mm-hmm. An original driver's license in Oregon today is $60. Renewal is $40. That gives you kind of a sense of the amounts there.
Right.
If we charge another $5 or $10 for the new card, it'd still be close, basically, and less definitely than a passport, $135
right
expense.
Well, the one thing that I'm concerned about, and this is beyond you folks, but the federal government may be setting up yet another barrier for lower income people to be able to access these things and move about. Some of us who have the money, and I already have a passport, so we can already take care of that cost. But I just worry that this is – I understand the safety aspect, but I worry that it's just another barrier that we're – you know, another hurdle that we're putting up there. The other question that I have, if I may ask one more, is how many breaches have we had of people getting on airplanes with bad ID that's caused a problem? And again, I'm not undermining the safety. Everybody wants to get to a location safely, but do we have any idea of what the need is here?
Chair McEwen, Ripson Gorsuch, we have no information really on that type of thing. It's outside of, you know, the realm of our responsibility. I will say, though, I think our cards are pretty secure, and the processes we use today to issue are good. They're solid. It's other things like keeping copies of documents,
right.
And we do criminal background checks on our employees, but they're not fingerprint based; they're name based criminal background checks, which are good, but don't quite meet the requirement of the federal regulations.
Okay.
We verify Social Security numbers when you first apply, and if it looks good, we say great, and we hand the card back to the person if they present it to us, but we don't check it again. The regulations would require that every time you come in for a replacement card or a renewal, that we check that federal database. That's one of the things we aren't doing today.
Do we know why the federal folks are so fixated on you having a copy? Well, I mean, that seems a tad bit inflexible, perhaps.
Chair McEwen, Rep. Gorsuch, I believe it's for investigative purposes. That's the idea. That if there is some kind of identity fraud, identity theft, a terrorist attack, or the driver's license is tied in somehow, that they have some way to go back and see, well, what did that document look like? What did it say? Perhaps where was it issued? That type of thing.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Bentz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So you have repeatedly and carefully and succinctly appeared before us with this. The sky is about to fall. And you're right. How do we make sure, what would you recommend that we do so we don't find ourselves with everybody in Oregon saying, why didn't you sooner? What you gave us the deadlines. We need to, is there a proposal you're going to make to us, and you may have said so, in this upcoming session that will give us a moment to either move or not on the funding of this program? Or is this going to be something that we need to tell the Oregonians we decided it's just not worth it, go get a passport? So I guess it's a combination of questions, but I think you get it.
Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, to start, I will say we are not proposing or recommending any action at this time. This is an informational piece. And I can also tell you that ODOT has not submitted a legislative concept for Real ID compliance for 2017. We appeared earlier this week in front of the E-Board Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, and I believe they're meeting right now in full. And the recommendation back to us, or the direction back to us from that group, was to come forward either early next session or even really before next session with a pretty robust report on several different options and the costs for each of those. So we have quite a bit of deep analysis to do between now and the 2017 session. I've also been made aware that at least a couple of legislators intend to introduce bills for the 2017 session for some level of movement on the Real ID topic, whether that's just, I refer to it as kind of lifting the shackles, right, lifting the prohibition all the way to lifting the prohibition and, you know, here's one version of a solution. So I think, you know, the understanding that this needs to be a conversation, I think, in 2017 about the way forward, and that is where we are at as a department.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
Is there a value to Oregonians of this card in its most aggressively identifying the form, other than just getting on airplanes? In other words, is there something we can point out to say we're not doing this just because of federal dictate? It also helps us in the following respects. And if so, what are they?
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, I'm a bit hard-pressed to identify additional benefits. It truly is that the federal facilities and federal access issues. If you're an Oregonian who's stationed at a military base in another state, who's relied on their Oregon driver's license to access different parts of that base, that person will have to find some other way, some other document that would be accepted to get around. So there's a benefit to that individual to have a card that, you know, meets those requirements. But as far as additional benefits, additional assurances in some way that the card is better in some way than our standard card that we issue, I'm not sure that it is measurably that much better.
Representative McClain?
You made a comment, though, just recently that it would be this, that we've got a timing issue here. Mm-hmm. You're changing your systems. You're working through a new card just for us, a new vendor just for us on our driver's license. So is there a savings that we should be considering as far as the timing issue on this? Because you also indicated that, I mean, I think that Virginia sounds like they've got a good take on how to go forward on this. But it's one of those situations where if there's a timing issue and you bring me two proposals next year and we miss the window, of using some of these changes that you're working on right now, that doesn't seem like a good cost-benefit analysis. So is there any feeling there? What's the window on that work?
Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, the one project I think there might be a window there would be our imaging project. The phase we're in right now is the driver license application materials. We've been microfilming these we still do, and we have tons of microfiche.
Wow.
We're trying to get away from that. It's a big risk to us. So we're trying to get to imaging. Mm-hmm. That project is underway right now. And if we're to add additional documents as part of the driver licensing application process, mm-hmm. sooner rather than later is probably better as far as a cost benefit for that project. Because if they move along too far, it could be additional work and additional time and cost associated with that if the decision is made to add these other documents to the mix that they have to image.
Okay. Thank you. We're running a little bit long, but I think this is an important enough topic that it warrants a very robust discussion. So mm-hmm. any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much. We will stay tuned.
Okay.
Next in our informational hearing, I would like to call up Mr. Wildish and Mr. Hickey to talk about least cost policy for public works projects. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee.
I always thought that's what we had.
Please begin.
Okay, thank you. Chair McEwen, members of the House Interim Committee on Transportation, good morning. I'm Steve Wildish, Vice President of Wildish Land Company. We're a 80-year-old family-owned construction and sand and gravel company located in Eugene, Oregon. We currently employ about 350 people. I'm speaking on behalf of a coalition of Oregon contractors and their associations. We're here today because we're concerned about the Oregon public contracting law pertaining to public entities performing construction projects by their own crews, specifically ORS 279C305. We're advocating for changes in the law. Why? Because we believe the current law lacks transparency and accountability. The current law requires that before a contracting agency constructs a public improvement with its own equipment and personnel on a project estimated to cost more than $125,000, it must verify that the project by self-performing the work, it has taken the path of constructing the project at the least cost to the contracting agency. And said another way, that's the least cost to the public. The current law is not working. The requisite cost accounting does not encompass all costs associated with the work. And in many cases, public contracting agencies are not doing any estimates or calculations to support the public policy interest of contracting the public improvement at least cost. The public contracting statutes provides a process, a roadmap, if you will, for public contracting agencies to self-perform work. Unfortunately, some agencies are traveling off-road, freewheeling it, choosing to disregard the law. John Hickey, Executive Director of the Asphalt Paving Association of Oregon, will talk about some examples of what we see happening. As employment is being wrongfully taken away from our skilled private sector labor force. Over the years, most contractors have watched public contracting agencies self-perform work that, to them, is anything but least cost. What remedy does the current law provide? Well, we can take legal action, we can file a lawsuit, but I hope you can understand that is the last thing that we want to do, especially with respect to the public owners that we perform work for. Our proposed amendments require clear and objective cost accounting and include a process to investigate violations, which is entirely lacking in the current law. The current law is weak. We need to strengthen it. Some time ago, a public works director explained to us why his agency could perform the work cheaper. He said that his trucking costs were $6 an hour compared to our $50 an hour rate. When we asked him to explain, the director said, well, we already own the equipment, we already employ the people, so our only cost to do the trucking is the cost of fuel and tires. Well, if the law provided for this type of cost analysis, we wouldn't have a private sector. It's time that things change. We ask that you support our proposed amendments to the public contracting provisions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Chair McEwen, committee members, I'll start by just giving you a little bit of background about myself. I was a civil engineer for a number of years. I'm a registered professional engineer in Oregon and Massachusetts.
Oh, your name for the record.
John Hickey.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Registered professional engineer in Oregon and Massachusetts. I've worked on the design and construction of construction, public and private projects. I became a lawyer and practiced law in Oregon and Washington for just under 10 years, focusing almost exclusively on construction law, representing private contractors and cities and counties, local agencies, on everything from bidding, the public contracting code, contracts, disputes, all of the above. For about 2 years now, I've been executive director of the Asphalt Pavement Association of Oregon. But as Steve mentioned, I'm not here only speaking on behalf of the paving contractors today. We're part of an industry coalition, a coalition of construction industry associations, the concrete and aggregate producers, ourselves, the utility contractors, and the local chapter of the AGC. We got together to form this coalition because we have memberships that are absolutely passionate about this issue. And it's not an issue that's new to us. We have documents on this exact issue dating back to the 1970s. And what we've seen is it hasn't shrunk, it hasn't gone away. The reverse has happened. It's grown, especially in recent years. So as an industry, we decided we had to get together, form a coalition, try to get something done. So today, I'm going to touch on a couple of examples, just to hopefully give you some perspective of the issue. We'll talk about the current law, what the problems are, we think, with the laws, and some possible solutions. I have a bunch of examples at the end of my presentation. I know we don't have time for that. I'm not going to get into those, but they're there for some other time, maybe some other context. We can talk about those. Before I get into my first example, I want to touch on what Steve was talking about and maybe summarize it a little bit, put it in my own words. The issue really boils down to, what does a public agency have to do if it wants to build a construction project of more than $125,000 with its own employees? Right. In construction, we usually ensure efficiency, quality, and a reasonable price through competition. Right. Competition is fundamental to construction, not only in Oregon, everywhere. Construction contractors wake up every day and think, how do we get better at what we do? Because they know if they don't evolve, their competitors are going to be doing the work, right? And they'll be out of business. So the public contracting code says, public agency, if you're just going to bypass all competition and just do the work yourselves, there's some things you have to do. And I'll talk about all of those things in a few minutes. But for right now, I want to focus on two. One of those things is do a preliminary analysis to show you're not going to be wasting public money by doing the work without competition. And the other thing is track your costs as you go. Right? I combine those two things and say it's just common sense money management. Think before you spend more than six figures in public money and track your costs as you go. Right? If any one of us were building a major construction project with our own money, that's what we would do. think the project through ahead of time and track our costs as we went. So with that, I want to focus on a couple of examples here. So you'll notice in these examples, too, I don't call out any names, and we did that purposefully. We didn't want to make this a finger-pointing punishment type of situation. We have the documents to back up all of these examples, and we're more than willing to sit down with anybody and go through. But for purposes of this presentation, we've kept it a little generic. So in this example, we have a construction of a city street in an Oregon city. This is a photo of what the street looked like beforehand. It's a gravel passageway. This is a photo of the street while public crews were building the project. And as you can see, it is an improvement. Right? They're building something new. This project entails taking out the gravel, digging down to subgrade, putting in base rock, putting in utilities, drainage structures, curbing, sidewalk, pavement, traffic control, a lot of things. So we have a member of one of our associations drive by and see public crews doing work that they would otherwise compete for. Tells us about it, so we do a public records request and say, hey, we see this work going on. We know it's more than $125,000. Could you show us your analysis that you did ahead of time and your cost accounting for the job? This is what we got in response, part of what we got in response. Having reviewed your request, we're able to inform you that the city does not possess the requested public records. No formal plans, specifications, or cost estimates have been prepared for this project to date. So after we get this response, our member goes and meets with the city, right? Because they work in that area, they know the people, and they say, look, we think a little bit more is required under the public contracting code. And not in these exact words, but the response was basically, that's just not how we do things here. Example number two, we have paving of a major road in an urban area. And this happens more than you might think, but we end up with two public agencies, or one public agency working for another public agency. And we end up with two different public crews from two different parts of government doing one project. So we see this work happening on a main road in an urban area by public crews, and again, we ask, hey, could you show us your cost analysis and show us your cost accounting for the job? They don't have the preliminary cost analysis. They did have some accounting of costs, and their estimates were that they accounted for about $328,000 in public dollars to do this work. The problem being, when we actually look at the costs, they omit costs that we know they have. Every construction project, whether it's done by the public or the private, has some bit of overhead, some bit of administration. Somebody has to do the scheduling. Somebody has to do the payroll. There's stuff that has to happen. None of those costs were allocated to this job. And we look at their equipment costs. Our members own the same equipment. We know how much it costs to buy the equipment, maintain it, and how accounting principles say you should allocate that cost over the life of that piece of equipment. It's not rocket science. They have equipment cost data that is unreasonably low. And we think that they just guesstimate their equipment costs. And sometimes it might be close, and sometimes it isn't. And on this job, it wasn't. But even if we take their numbers, they're at over $300,000 in public money. And they tried to explain in response to our public records request why they did the work in-house without a cost analysis. And they say, you know, the location of the project was developed in-house concurrently with contracted outwork. So we did some contracted outwork on other projects. But the first reason we did it in-house is that staff responsible for developing bid documents that would go to contractors, they were at capacity, busy. Second reason is that we strive to complete some projects with maintenance staff to maintain their paving skills. So, in other words, if we're busy and we want to practice, we just do it. And I can tell you, the public contracting code does not have an exception for busyness or wanting to practice. Not there. So, with those two examples, I want to shift back to the law and talk about what the public contracting code currently requires. The code says that public agencies shall use every effort to construct public improvements at the least cost. And it ensures that through competition, competitive low bidding, or competitive proposals. And I want to be clear that we're not talking about maintenance work here. Sealing the road, pothole repairs, crack sealing, culvert repair, tree removal, all the stuff that a public works department typically does, not subject to the code. It's when they want to do larger construction projects that are improvements. That, you know, when you're maintaining what you have, that's the public works crew domain. When you're building something that's going to be an improvement to what you have, you know, we think that that should be subject to competition in the private industry. So when we're focused on construction, the code says if you're going to bypass competitive low bidding or competitive proposals, you got to do those things. We talked about the cost analysis and the cost accounting. These are the other things that they have to do. They have to send every budget period a list of public improvement projects that they intend to do to BOLI. And they need to say on that list whether they intend to do the work in-house or through a private contractor. BOLI will be the first one to tell you that they do nothing with these lists. They have no enforcement authority. So BOLI takes the lists and puts them in a file. That's it. And if an agency doesn't send the list, BOLI does nothing because they have no statutory authority to enforce the requirement. Separate from that, public agencies have to have a cost accounting system. We talked about that. And then if the project that they want to perform is more than $125,000, they have to show how the decision complies with the least cost policy. That's the analysis. They have to prepare plans and specifications, estimate the unit cost of each work classification, and keep an accounting. Again, summarizing it all up, common sense money management. Think before you spend, just think the project through, track your costs as you go. Some of the problems we see, and these are kind of evident when you think about the examples I had, include we have agencies that just, that's not how they do it. And we also have agencies that don't use actual costs. They'll leave out overhead. They'll leave out administration costs. They'll put in costs $13 an hour because that's what they pay their employee. We know there's burden. There's a burden rate on top of that. They leave that out, right? And so we have these weird cost records that don't actually account for actual costs. And we have agencies that say, we don't know how to do it. How do you expect us to estimate and budget construction and compare that to the cost of a construction contractor? Now, you might think, if you have an agency that has no idea how to budget and estimate construction work, maybe that agency shouldn't be performing major construction work. But what we say to those agencies is, have you asked? Have you asked your local contracting community that you work with all the time how they would estimate the work and what they think their costs would be? And they invariably say, well, we don't do that. We don't know how to do it. And we also have a situation where there's no real apples-to-apples comparisons that get done. And when you have a construction project, there's a pool of risks. There's a lot of risks. Enough risks that it's put more than one contractor out of business. Right. When you hire a private contractor to do that construction project, some of those risks get shifted to that private contractor. Right? The contractor bears the burden of that risk. When you just do it with the public employees, all of that risk stays on the public. Right? And so there's a value there. Contractors bring family wage jobs. Every contractor in Oregon working on a public project pays prevailing wage rates. Every employee on that job makes a family wage. And contractors are subject, we can get into the weeds here really quickly, but I'll just hit on some, you know.
Sir, we're already about 10 minutes behind, so try to get into the weeds too far, please.
Yeah, on the high points. One thing that I think is important in the apples to apples stuff is the quality, right? on a private construction job, there's an arm's length transaction between the public entity and the contractor. So that contractor is subject to quality standards and enforced through an inspector or a public works department. When the public agency does the work themselves, they judge their own workmanship. There's an inherent conflict of interest. And we've seen it where they have done poor quality and have just left it and let it fail. And we think, you know, there's some certainty in having contractors have to finish by a deadline and provide bonds. There's a lot of security in contracting with the private entity. Perhaps the biggest problem for us is the one listed last on this slide, which is the remedies are completely ineffective. You have to sue the agency to get enforcement. The construction industry has to sue the agency. I've been in lawsuits. They destroy relationships, right? The two people who win in the lawsuit, the lawyer for the plaintiff and the lawyer for the defendant, right? Not the parties. And think about how that would work here. We don't know they're going to do this until we see it happening. Right? In the example, somebody drives by and says, whoa, that's public crew doing what I would compete for. Then we have to do a public records request. That takes weeks. And we often don't get the records in 2 weeks. We get a response from their lawyer when they figure out, oh, we didn't do this stuff. They send it to their lawyer. Everything gets reviewed. By a month and a half, 2 months later, we might get the records. Then we need to look at them. Then we would have to file a lawsuit. The job's over.
It would be helpful if you could get to what the remedy is and what the bill concept is.
Okay, I'll do that right now.
Thank you.
So we think there needs to be changes, but no change in policy, right? We think before you spend, track your costs as you go, makes sense. We think we need some clarity on how they can do that initial showing, that we can write down some common sense construction estimating principles that everyone would apply to make it really simple to make that good faith showing on the front end. And we think, given the ineffectiveness of lawsuits, that there should, and the amount of money at stake. We have examples of, you know, $1 million+ on one of these jobs. That it makes sense to have some minimal government oversight by the Secretary of State or BOLI, some agency oversight of what they're doing, so we take it out of the lawsuit realm. And we also think that, you know, when we brought this up to ODOT, they were concerned about this interfering with their maintenance program. We can clarify that we're not talking about maintenance. So in short, I can end with that. We think some clarity, some enforcement, and again, confirmation that we're talking about construction projects.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I'm sure there are questions from the panel. Representative Hack.
Thank you for the great information today. I think one of the things that we're probably going to hear from opponents of the concept is that it's going to create more work, more paperwork, all that. So as an engineer and someone that deals with this, do you foresee, obviously that's something that should be happening anyway. Should there be an increase in paperwork? Is this just, I'm just going to throw that out there because we'll probably hear that.
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack. On that issue, I would say no more paperwork than if they were complying with the law right now. And I would say any construction project of any magnitude already will have an engineering estimate. We do it every day in the world of engineering, is estimate some cost. And we think if we make clear rules on the construction estimating principles, it will simplify things greatly, where it can be, okay, these are the things we have to cover to show our good faith analysis, and actually reduce paperwork over right now this uncertain showing that they have to make. Mm-hmm. We can potentially make it easier, but if they aren't doing it now, oh yeah, it's going to be a little bit more. But again, it's a control that we think is necessary.
Just one more.
Yes.
When you talk about the fact that the private sector has to ensure the work and answers to the inspectors and those kinds of things, yet if the work is done on the public side, they don't do that, how oftentimes do you go back and see, or folks that you represent have to go back and clean up the messes, and how costly is that in comparison to if they had done the work and done it right in the first place?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, It all depends. It's hard to answer that. I can say that I was on a paving project last week where a paver had to repave about 2,000 feet at, you know, a few thousand dollars at no cost to the public, at their own cost. And in August, I was on a public job where they paved a section of road off of a main highway, and it was done according, horribly done. In paving, it's really important to go straight because you have to match the joint. You've all seen cracks right at the joint. That's because it was paved wrong. I watched them pave it incorrectly and just walk away. So that is going to fail, and then it'll be a cost to the public in the future.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions?
Now, Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Representative Bentz.
So this is a thank you for your testimony and a great presentation. Have you guys seen a growth in the amount of equipment and other stuff that cities have acquired over time? So that because if we go back to the heart of the matter, what we have are cities that have these departments and have this equipment and have these people, and they need to have them doing something. And so then the department tends to grow. It's been my observation that in my part of the world that hasn't necessarily been the case, but maybe a little. But can you trace through what's really going on here? What's driving these locals to do this? Is it to keep the people busy that they have on board, or what? Why are they doing this?
Chair McEwen, Representative Benz, I'd be speculating a lot in answering this question. I'll tell you part of my personal view on it. I think we have well-intentioned people who are experienced in construction, and the tendency is to want to do more and grow the importance and the need for your group. And we have maintenance work out there, plenty of it across the state that they could be doing. Some of them would rather be doing the bigger projects. And I think some of them, having never really compared their cost to that of a contractor, think that they can do it for less. You know, our point isn't that it always needs to go to the private industry. We think most of the time that's the case when you're doing a major construction project. But what we're asking them to do, just give us the fair analysis that's already required. So I do think that the public crews have grown over time, and we can go over, it's probably for a different presentation, the amount of equipment. You know, some public agencies in the state of Oregon have the biggest construction fleet in the state, bigger than any private contractor operating in the state, and a lot of that equipment sits idle for a long, long time. And so the hourly cost of using that is astronomical, but they don't cost their equipment that way. So I think it is a problem, and it may be worth exploring why this happens, but we're more focused on, hey, just think before you spend, track your cost as you go.
Follow up, Madam Chair. We're having the same debate in the firefighting arena, where private folks would like to be retained. And instead we see federal agencies acquiring more and more and more and more equipment in lieu of retaining private folks to do the firefighting. It's a really interesting conversation, and there's some striking similarities, and there's some dramatic differences. But so enjoy your presentation.
Yeah, I think it was a wonderful presentation. Any further comment? I think what comes to mind for me, not only as a legislator but as a taxpayer, is the accountability and transparency issue that you raise. And what I'm hearing you say, I believe, is that we already have the capability on the books to encourage cities and counties in the state to provide this information, not only to you as a contractor, but to the taxpayer, who ultimately is responsible for footing the bill when these things don't go properly. And so I appreciate your interest in seeing that information, but if I live in a city and I think that my city is not being transparent or accountable or spending my tax dollars wisely, that's a grave concern. I would be interested, you used a couple of examples, and one was a city, but across the state, you know, kind of looking outside of your bailiwick, do you see this being a statewide issue at the city, county, and state level? Or are there areas where you're seeing this as more of a problem or more of an issue than in other parts of the state? I mean, is this across the board?
So, Chair McEwen, I represent Paving Contractors contractors across the state. There are concerns and examples from across the state.
Madam Chair, at all levels of government?
Yes, although there are more, there are pockets, but we have seen it as from at the top end and at the low end.
Representative McLean.
Well, because of some of the last comments that were made, I want to make this statement. First of all, I thought your presentation was clear, concise, and it gave me something to want to look at. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing one side of the story right now. This is a one-sided panel, okay? And so I have an interest as a legislator and a thinking person to look at the full picture, too. And so I appreciate your comments. I appreciate the ideas. I appreciate the goal of transparency and the goal of really making sure we're doing good record keeping and good bidding. My husband was a machinist. You have to bid out your project. You have to deal with the rules of contracting. I'm there for you on your goals. But I don't know the whole story. I know your story. And so I appreciate the comments. I appreciate the presentation. But I think we all have more research and more reading and more of a bigger picture to look at than just this one presentation.
Any follow-up? Great. Gentlemen, thank you so much. This was very informative, and we appreciate your time in coming to talk to us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're running a little behind, but I think we'll be just fine at the end of the day. Mr. Russell. How are you this morning?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm doing just fine. Thank
Welcome
you.
To our committee, sir.
And let me see what I can do to get us back on track. Oh. I have a very simple concept. last November, Congress passed the Federal Highway Reauthorization Bill, known as the FAST Act. In that bill, it allowed states to increase truck weights in two different areas. One, if they're powered by natural gas, and the issue is that the tanks for natural gas are much heavier, and it reduces our payload, which our customers don't appreciate. So if we increase the weight for natural gas trucks, then we can continue to haul the same amount of payload. They also authorize states to increase weights for trucks that are equipped with auxiliary power units by 100 pounds. Auxiliary power units are units on the truck that allow the driver to shut down the main engine and still have air conditioning and heating and those kinds of things. In the early days of APUs, they were powered by small diesel engines, but today in today's world, we're powering them with batteries. The batteries weigh more, and that's the reason that the federal government has increased the weight allowance by 100 pounds. Because the FAST Act was not passed until November, it was too late to get a standalone bill for the February session. There was only one bill that had the right relating clause, and the sponsor of that bill was kind enough to let me amend this into that bill. That was Senate Bill 1510. Unfortunately, the other portion of that bill proved to be fairly controversial, and it did not move. So I'm requesting that for the 17 session that you have this concept drafted and introduce a committee bill. That's my request.
Short and sweet. Thank you very much. CNG and LNG for the gas?
Yes.
Fueling?
It just says natural gas.
Okay. Questions? Comments? Thank you, sir.
It's pretty simple, straightforward.
Thank you very much.
Gets us back on time. Look at
it
that.
Certainly
Good
does.
Job,
we may be early.
There you
wow.
go.
We're doing all right. Next, we have a very interesting. I'm delighted to invite some of my colleagues to give us a presentation today on an entrepreneurship development initiative that is a part of a Business Oregon initiative, and it just happens to be in my district. And I'm delighted to welcome today Connie Stouffer, who is the director of the South Coast Development Council, and Janet Soto to talk about just a program that I'm very excited about. This I'll tell you the reason I'm tickled by this. I've been watching in my Higher Ed Innovation and Workforce Development Committee for the last couple of years, you know, a lot of entrepreneurship programs and that are happening around the metro area and in the valley. And there's been conversation about what do we do for our entrepreneurs who are living in the rural parts of the state where it's difficult to travel to Portland or travel to the valley to get the support that they need to launch their businesses. And so I was tickled. I didn't know this was occurring until just a couple of weeks ago. And there is a pilot program that happens to be in my community that I'm delighted to have Connie here to talk about. So welcome to our committee, ladies. We're delighted to have you today.
Thank you, Chair McEwen. Vice Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Soto-Rodriguez, Entrepreneurship Strategist for Business Oregon, and I'm here today. I'm also very excited to share this new initiative from Business Oregon that is prioritizing rural communities and our rural businesses. At this time, we are working with four community-led efforts, and those efforts are being led in Klamath Falls, Coos Bay, LeGrand, and Baker City. In each community, this local collaborative is made up of existing service providers who are first looking at where are we strong and what do we offer the community, and secondly, where are there gaps in our service services. What we are learning from each community is the remarkable work that's already taking place and about their incredible strengths, but we are also learning about the isolation that our rural partners experience, and also the limits when it comes especially to specialized services. To help our rural business partners, Business Oregon is investing in rural, locally driven strategies designed to increase access to existing business services. Our rural entrepreneurship is not creating new programs. I want to be really clear about that. With 11 economic development districts, 19 small business development centers, countless number of chambers, nonprofits, for-profits, not to mention community colleges, universities, local and federal government programs, we know that in the state of Oregon, we don't suffer from a lack of service providers, but we do know that in Oregon, what we suffer from is a uncoordinated, difficult to navigate technical resource system that leaves a lot of entrepreneurs feeling like a ping pong ball and like they're being shuffled around. For some of them, the services are invisible, and we also know that depending on where you live, those services are unequal. So to address this fractured system, we believe that we strengthen existing efforts by bringing resource providers together. With over 340,000 registered Oregon businesses, we know that no single entity can service them all alone, and that we are better and stronger together, especially if we know who we are and where we service these businesses at what stage of their life. In Klamath Falls, LeGrand, Coos Bay, and Baker City, each community is developing an integrated solution developed by and for the local stakeholder communities who best recognize their strengths and economic needs. You will hear shortly from our partners in Coos Bay about their partnership, their vision, their local strategy, and what's happening in Coos Bay. But to give you a sense of how tailored each community is and how it looks different for each of them, I'm going to give an example with Klamath Falls. This effort is being led by the Klamath IDEA. It stands for Inspire Development and Energize Acceleration. They've been working on this since 2014, and they've gathered over 60 stakeholders in small and large meetings. And the idea was to map out the opportunities and challenges. For them, complementing existing services and not duplicating services has been a high priority. The initiative is presently being led by local resource partners, and they include the KCC Small Business Development Center, Oregon Tech, SCOED, Klamath County Chamber of Commerce, Oregon State University, Klamath County Economic Development Association, and Business Oregon. The SBDC director had this to say. The resource partners on the board have worked hard over the last couple of years to learn what the other partners can provide. That understanding is critical for us to be able to help an entrepreneur move through the ecosystem seamlessly while getting what they need in the most efficient fashion. We're collaborating well, and it's one of the most important things about the idea. Most recently, with the help of Business Oregon, this local group of providers is going to be able to increase the number of services that they provide, as well as open a Klamath Idea Center for Entrepreneurship, housing a dedicated downtown business training classroom. The center's Main Street facade will improve additional visibility for the initiative and build their long-term vision of creating an entrepreneurial town square. So for this initiative, co-locating to one building is not their vision. For this community, establishing strong partnerships among service providers, having consistent input from an entrepreneur-led committee, and having a Main Street presence that will then lead to, they hope to have a 6-block radius where they actually have flags up and it'll be designated as an entrepreneurial town square, and entrepreneurs will know that they have a place in the community and where they go to find all of these resource providers. And that is how they're going to realize their vision for their community. In LeGrand, it's totally different. The resource partners there are still in a very early stages, and no long-term vision has been set. However, in partnership with the City of LeGrand, Northeast Oregon Economic Development District, as well as a fire history museum and a fire-themed brewery, they are going to revitalize a historic downtown building to open a center for entrepreneurship that will also have a firefighter theme, and they're calling it right now the Jump Sheet, a landing pad for entrepreneurs. In Baker, the model is different there, too, and it's actually the expansion of an existing successful Hatch model, and this will be their second center. And as you can hear, each community has a completely different approach. It's being led entirely by the local service providers. The intent is to leverage existing investments, to leverage existing business services, and to map out where their gaps are and incentivize creative thinking to fill those gaps and connect them to all of the statewide resources. So I'll turn now to our local partners in Coos Bay so that you can hear about their vision and the incredible work that they're doing.
Thanks, Janet. Thank you, Chair McEwen, Vice Chair, and committee members. I'm really delighted to be here today to share with you what we're doing in Coos Bay. Obviously, all four centers are very exciting, but as Janet mentioned, we're all very unique.
Name for the record, Ms. Stoffer. Yeah.
My name is Connie Stoffer. I'm the Executive Director of the South Coast Development Council.
Thank you.
But each community is very different, partially because rural communities have similarities in the obstacles that they have to overcome. We're all unique communities and have different existing resources and different strengths to play off of. And so the center in Coos Bay has really started to look at the path that entrepreneurs have to go through to start their business. And while we have a diverse and very hardworking service partners in our communities, we're all kind of siloed. We're in our own spaces. And if you're an entrepreneur, you have to know that each of us exists to even know what path you'd go to access those resources. And to be honest, as service providers too, it's hard for us to coordinate programs and initiatives and work together just because we are all so busy and in different places. And so that's really where we decided to all come together and find a central location. In your packets, you'll see on the front page the building that we've selected. It's in the heart of the Coos Bay downtown. It's on Central Street. It's in a historic building that once housed office buildings or offices on the top floors and retail on the ground floor. On the second page, you'll see the list of partners in about the middle of the page that have already signed letters of interest to co-locate together and collaborate on programs and services within that building. And I brought along Eric Dunker from OSU Extension, who's one of those partners that has been working on this project with us from the beginning. And so we're all very excited. And as you can see from that list, we have tribal governments, we have nonprofits, we have universities, we have our building codes office. So we really think that no matter what you need as an entrepreneur, you'll be able to find it in that building.
Would you like to invite him to come join you at the dais in case there are questions?
That's all right.
Please come up and join us. No problem. You're welcome.
And so then we've got all those partners together and started really talking about, well, what else do we need besides co-location? That's just one piece of the puzzle that would make it easier for entrepreneurs. And we started looking at what gaps we have in our community. And the Coos Bay area doesn't have an incubation center at all. We don't have a co-working space at all. And we don't have a commercial kitchen available for food-based entrepreneurs. And a high percentage of the businesses that we see are in some way food-related. And so those were all things that we decided to put into our facility. And so if you flip back to that front page, you'll see that the building is 3 stories. The top floor is where all of our partners will be co-located. The middle floor will be co-working space, incubator space, shared conference rooms and meeting space and training space, so that entrepreneurs will be able to access trainings virtually that we're getting from any of the four centers and from Portland, so that we have access to all of those trainings as well. And then the ground floor will be a mix of retail, our commercial kitchen, and retail incubator spaces. And so really we'll have just about everything that an entrepreneur ecosystem would require so that businesses can be successful in a rural community. And as you can see from the pictures, the building needs a lot of love. But for any of you that's toured some historic buildings in all rural communities, every rural community has a building like this that's been sitting vacant and empty. The upper floors of this building have been vacant for almost 40 years. So it's 40 years this building has been in the heart of our downtown, not being vital and used like it should be. The ground floor does have existing businesses in there now, but really we have this huge resource in our community that we're not using. And really, if you're a business that's wanting to get started, where better than the heart of your small downtown? And so we've been really blessed to be able to have been approached by Business Oregon to take this on. While all of us would have dreamed of doing something like this, we really didn't have the capacity or the launch pad to do it until Business Oregon approached us. And so they've been providing technical assistance. They provided seed funding for us to get this project started, because we're all small nonprofits and small communities, and really have been walking us along the process all along the way. And each community has been doing the same thing. And so it's been a really exciting process, and we're just getting started. We have the building identified. We're moving right along with that, but I'm really excited to see where this is going to take us in a couple of years, and all the businesses that will be able to get started and be vibrant and really grow our rural community.
And I would love to invite you to talk about the role that your organization will be playing in this.
Sure. The role that we've
identified. And your name for the record, sir.
Sorry. My name is Eric Dunker. I'm the Coastal Regional Administrator for Oregon State University Extension. So I oversee six county extension offices along the Oregon coast and Columbia County. Mm-hmm. We started talking with Connie October,
it's
November.
Been
well. Mm-hmm. So. In parallel to this, we've been creating a new initiative around rural tourism, destination development, support for the South Coast region. So we just invested in a new position down there. And as we were investing in that position and creating the position description, and this is the first kind of position for OSU Extension, and we're piloting it on the coast because we know that rural tourism is such a vital component to the coastal economy. And we're going to be applying, providing research-based support for small business owners, regional planners, you name it. And when this concept started coming to fruition, the Center for Entrepreneurship, we figured, why don't we actually use all of our expertise in the area? So we have expertise in agriculture, forestry, natural resources, commercial fishing, and now tourism, which sort of cover primarily the main industries in the area. So what if we co-located, layered the current support that a small business development center can offer in business planning with research-based information and potential interns, whether it's graduate interns for projects that are identified in the various areas. We can tap into other faculty expertise through OSU. We can write grants together. So we feel like this is a direction that we want to move for OSU Extension, at least on the coast. And this is, to me, a great opportunity for us to just better serve the community in conjunction with existing partners. So.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, and thank you all for your testimony and for being here today. Could you talk about if you've experienced any successes thus far with an entrepreneur or a company, or getting away from the idea of if we build it, they will come, but this is an organic thing that you talked about. Entrepreneurs often feel like they're bumped from here to there, and of course mm-hmm. They're up at 5 a.m. just trying to pull themselves up by their bootstraps in a lot of ways, like what you're doing, creating this opportunity. But are you already seeing your efforts in integrating your agencies and groups impacting entrepreneurs in your community?
Chair McCune, Representative Davis. This is a very new initiative. As Chair McCune said, she's only recently learned about it, but each community is in a different place. In Baker City, they're getting ready to open their doors in 2 weeks, and in Klamath Falls, they will open the first week of October. And really, when it comes down to what are the success stories are actually countless, and I'm happy to provide a number of that data for you, but what it is a history and a trajectory of each of these service providers and what they're doing in their communities. So, for example, in Klamath Falls, this is being led by the Small Business Development Center down there, and they have countless stories of entrepreneurs that they have helped to date. And so really, it's just building on the momentum of the success and the stories that have already taken shape and are really making an impact in communities. Pertaining to this specific initiative and bringing and co-locating all the service providers, we're still too early yet to map out and say this is specific to this effort. And I don't know if you all want to add to that.
Well, I mean, and like Janet mentioned, it is pretty early and we haven't opened our facility yet, but this news is of this facility is spreading. And even though it's really new, I've had a number of entrepreneurs call and say, when is the space going to be available? Because they're really excited about the opportunity. And so we've had a restaurant, we have a running store, we have a social media networking company that have all inquired about space. And so I have no doubt that once we have a space available for them, that they'll find success within it.
Yes. And part of it is I was trying to get beyond the idea of we're just going to create a space for people to be. What you really create is relationships for entrepreneurs to have. Mm-hmm. And I hope that even before you have a physical space open, when somebody is, and I'm sure you are, this is a softball question, by the way. I'm sure you have an example of somebody who has called and said, I'm looking for this. Do you know who I can talk to? How I can get this resource?
And Vice Chair Davis, I'm going to follow up with an example that just highlights why I think this is so important for communities that they have highlighted here today. I met a young man probably 3 years ago that's a young entrepreneur that lives 15 miles up Coos River. Travel is difficult, doesn't have a lot of resources, who has patented a very special device. It's an LED light bulb. And it's a hand-blown bulb, and the it's patented because the chemical makeup of the glass is very unique, and it takes LED light and disperses it in a way that is very effective. And so we have a local new brewery that has opened that has used his light bulbs in their restaurant and in the brewery. We have Shark Bites, which is another restaurant downtown, which has used this lighting in their facility to great effect. And this young man needs help getting this off the ground. And so I've had many conversations with him trying to hook him up with folks in Portland and people in Eugene, and for him to travel is very difficult. And we've been working with him for quite some time, and it's been an incredible struggle. And so to see something like this where this young man can walk in and have the services that he needs available, I think is going – and he's just one example of an opportunity that is kind of had a really tough time getting going because we didn't have this available to him. So I'm really excited about it. And I want you to note that on page – the second page, which will date me, I think was my old dentist's office when I was a little kid. way back in the day.
Your name on
Dr. Laird, Dr. Laird's chair. I used to look right out that window when I was a very small child. My sister used to run away scared, screaming from the dentist's office there.
So you're saying that this building's been unoccupied for 20 years.
40 years, which dates me.
For 10 years,
which just tickles me when I look at that. But I just wanted to thank Connie for coming up here. Thank you for your participation at Oregon State. And I had the privilege of sitting around a table, Connie, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And there's some folks that are missing. I think, could you just go down the list of the other entities that you are tapping in? I know you are applying for some grants from a lot of places, and there were all the people in the room coming from the right places to help out.
We were. So on the list, we have Southwestern Oregon, community college. So we had originally been looking at a building on their campus. They have an entrepreneur degree program. That building wasn't the perfect fit, but through those conversations, we started talking about how can we integrate those entrepreneur students into the center. And so that's going to be a perfect kind of capstone for that program, as well as the students at Oregon Community or Oregon Coast Culinary Institute, which is a premier culinary program that we have on the coast, because we'll have a commercial kitchen for those who want to start their own businesses, which is really exciting for the college. Oregon State University, of course, the Coquel Economic Development Corporation, which has an economic development arm, the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. They also have an economic development arm and had recently received a grant to create an incubator center. And we thought, you're creating an incubator, we're creating an incubator, why don't we do it together, not be duplicative? And so we're partnering in that way to provide better entrepreneur programs for tribal members. CCD Business Development, which is our EDD, the Southwestern Oregon Workforce Investment Board. As you know, workforce is a crucial component for businesses being able to grow, and so we're really going to be integrating what they do into the programs. Government Contract Acquisition Program, Business Oregon, of course, the Coos Bay Downtown Association, since we're in the downtown, and farmers markets are often kind of little mini incubators, and so we'll be partnering with them on that. The Building Permits Office, Oregon Community Foundation, which is a granting organization, also asked if they can have office space, and we said, of course, because granting is sometimes a crucial component for our small communities, and we keep having people ask for space, but I think we're actually at capacity for partner spaces if we want to make sure we still have space for entrepreneurs. So that's incredibly exciting for us to be able to do that already when we haven't even started construction yet, to already have all those partners signed on and saying, we want to collaborate, we want to provide services and see how we can really create this. And to Representative Davis's point, one of the exciting parts of these four pilot locations is that we'll all be connected via the web. So if there are trainings going on in Baker that perhaps we can't provide in Coos Bay, our entrepreneurs will be able to have access to those, and vice versa. So for the gentleman who creates the light bulbs, if he needs a training to really launch his business and scale up that we aren't providing currently, those trainings are certainly going on elsewhere in the state. And so we're not creating new programs, but just accessing the ones that are currently going on for our entrepreneurs so they can finally access all of those resources.
And Connie, were there some potential federal partners as well?
Yes. So we've already been talking to EDA, the Economic Development Administration, for funding for remodeling the building. We've also talked to USDA. They've each had a chance to look at the building and have had, you know, are familiar with it and are excited about the concept. And so we're currently filling out applications to both of those organizations for remodeling the building. The City of Coos Bay has agreed to use urban renewal funds to help us purchase the building and potentially use some of it for facade improvements as well. And so we've just got the appraisal back on the building, and so they'll be starting those negotiations soon. So we're moving right along, and so we're very excited about those.
Just to note, it's been very well thought out and very well planned, and Connie's doing a remarkable job of pulling all these threads together. So kudos to Connie.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
I'd just like to make a statement. This is very impressive, and again, knowing the rural communities, it's an important step. So we have a lot of conversation going towards 2017 about small business and small business growth. And so this is a prime example of some other things that we can probably do. What concerns me is we have the recommendation from the governor's cabinet. We have a committee I serve on, which is a small business growth, special small business. So we get all these conversations, and I wasn't even aware that this program exists. That's part of the problem.
Nor was I representative.
And so I appreciate your being here, but I'm just raising that. I think that all of us, I think we all have the same interest. But what I want to make sure we do is we look at what we're going to do, is we take examples in that and make sure we don't try to reinvent the wheel, and that we reinforce the wheel, right, that in many cases can work. So the timing, it was great that you were here, and I appreciate the work you've done.
Thank you to Biz Oregon for the work you've done to help support the efforts that are happening with REEF.
Thank you, Chair McKinnon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here today. On that note, I believe we are adjourned 5 minutes early.
Hey.
On that note, I believe we are adjourned 5 minutes early.